As planet Earth continues to boil, billionaires are setting their sights on the heavens. You might have heard about Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos or Richard Branson setting up space programs supposedly to usher humanity out to other planets, to colonize Mars and beyond. They aren't alone here. People of all different political stripes have imagined a human future beyond the limits of Earth's atmosphere. 19th century Russian scientist Konstantin Tsiolkovsky once famously opined that Earth is the cradle of humanity, but one cannot remain in the cradle forever. And here in the 21st century, governments and private industrialists alike are shaking off the restrictions of Cold War era space treaties and exploring mining, construction, technology, military expansion, and more in space. Some people are looking at this as the promise of a glorious new future. Others worry that the economic and geopolitical realities of this new space age pose big risks to Earth's security, its democracy, and its ecology. Daniel Dudney is an academic and writer teaching political science, international relations, and political theory at Johns Hopkins University. He's the author of the book Dark Skies: Space Expansionism, Planetary Geopolitics, and the Ends of Humanity. On this episode, he joined me to talk about the origins of the space age and its deep connections to the nuclear age, about Silicon Valley utopianism and the Cold War. We discussed climate change, resource extraction, and how this new space race is turning into a new arms race. Daniel, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Would you like to tell us first off how you got interested in this subject? Because some people might think of this as a concern for science fiction writers or a slim cache of these wild-eyed minoritarian Silicon Valley thinkers. And you're coming at this as a political scientist. So how did you come to this topic, and why do you think it's an urgent horizon of inquiry right now?
Well, like a lot of the people who are interested in space, I started when I was very young, growing up during the Apollo moon project era, 1960s in the United States, and also read a great deal of science fiction. And of course, science fiction has been, you know, the accelerant, the inspirational source for a lot of what has been done. And in subsequent years, I have studied space through the lenses of international relations theory and future studies, technology assessment, world order thinking, and trying to think about space and the within a framework that is planetary in character. You really can't talk about space or the beginnings of the human activities beyond the atmosphere that have occurred, you know, since the middle years of the 20th century without recognizing that it's not just that. There's a cluster of things which have occurred in roughly a decade. In the middle 1940s to middle 1950s, we had the V2, the beginning of the space age, the first human object to go beyond the Earth's atmosphere. We had fission weapons, thermonuclear weapons, the H-bomb, the first electronic digital computers, the beginning of what people call the Great Acceleration. Perhaps it's one of the beginning markers for the Anthropocene, an enormous increase in human activities on the biological support systems for life on this planet. All these things have been happening more or less simultaneously and unfolding, and you really can't, you know, make sense of one without the other fully. But in terms of why, you know, should we be concerned about this now? Space is at many ways an important juncture. There has been a great decline in the cost of lobbing objects beyond the Earth's atmosphere into orbit. And that had always been, and still remains, single most important barrier to doing increasingly large-scale activities in space. And the other thing which is happening right now, the nuclear weapons delivery system, which is actually a type of space weapon, is now being expanded and modernized across the great powers.
I would love to dig into the role of kind of science fiction a little more to start off with, and the kind of beginnings of the space-going imaginaries that have laid down the foundations for the kinds of cultural mythos and sort of cultural practices that we're seeing today. Can you tell us about those early imagineers who were first kind of looking at the stars and calling the Earth, you know, the cradle of humanity and that kind of thing?
Yes. Well, people have been looking at the skies and attributing enormous importance to what they think they're seeing from the beginning of our species. Mm. Astrology, the skies in religion, these civilizations built these giant pyramids that were, you know, aligned with the location of these celestial lights. And of course, the modern period, beginning, 500 years or so ago, you know, is marked by a complete transformation in our understanding of what it is that we're seeing. The Copernican Revolution and subsequent natural science investigations have essentially given us large-scale, first-order, accurate maps of this vast domain that is beyond the terrestrial Earth. And as people started to realize that this was so large and that had these various features, other bodies and so forth, they immediately started thinking about these places and spaces in ways that related to humans, and started to think about travel, that humans would travel to these places. And of course, much of this early, you know, proto-science fiction was, you know, very, very problematic on a lot of the scientific and technological details, but you basically had humans going to these other bodies. In the wake of the Industrial Revolution in the late 19th century, it started to become possible for people to build machines, to build artifacts, rockets, that would actually make this type of voyage possible. And it was really when that started to happen, later years of the 19th century, early years of the 20th century, we had this explosion of scientific, technological imaginary, futures, scenarios, possibilities. And really, there hasn't been much that's been added that's first order since then. There's been a lot of secondary and tertiary development of ideas that were first broached during that period. And the other thing that one would have to say about this giant spurt of imagination with regard to the realms beyond the terrestrial Earth is that from the very beginning of this period, a narrative was created that is in many ways the grandest narrative of scientific technological modernity, the grandest, you know, Enlightenment futurist prospect. And they have the advocates of this, the people who have, you know, articulated it, they associate going into space in terms that are macro-historical, species-defining, epoch-originating terms. Humans have a destiny, that humans have the prospect of becoming multiplanetary, you know, multi-solar system, that the universe is enormously large and the Earth is enormously small. But these people say, look at all this space for our expansion. And so we have people like Elon Musk and others are, you know, saying, We want to develop space so that there will be millions and then billions and then trillions of people living in space.
So let's talk a bit more about what you mentioned in terms of the nuclear age being very much practically and ideologically bound up with the space age. Could you tell us more about how that interconnected history evolved and the kind of legal infrastructure that began to emerge around it?
Well, the basic story of space weapons development, the basic story of the ballistic missile and of nuclear weapons, you know, is defined by, you know, interstate rivalry. The United States and the Soviet Union, you know, emerged from the Second World War as the preeminent powers. They were confronted with these new possibilities for violence technology, and they were both keenly aware that new innovations at scientific and technological frontiers could have defining impacts on the international balance of power, right? The nuclear weapon didn't exist at the outset of the Second World War. And so the project to aggressively weaponize science and technology was deeply ingrained in these states, and they poured immense quantities of resources into it. And much of the post-World War II earth sciences in both the United States and the Soviet Union was part of the attempt by military organizations to understand the places in which they were going to be battling and the various consequences of the weapons that they were fabricating.
I'm wondering how, in your view, the development of nuclear weapons, something of a sort of an absolute weapon in your words, that kind of grants a smaller and smaller, kind of practically speaking, number of people, number of polities, a potentially decisive power over the future of humanity. How has that sort of changed the game in terms of the questions that we need to be asking when it comes to international collaboration in terms of international politics?
Well, I think that the best answer to that is a line of argumentation that I refer to as nuclear one worldism. And this is a set of claims that were developed initially right at the beginning of the nuclear era. And this line of thinking, this nuclear one worldist line of thinking, is not by any means dominant among people who think about nuclear weapons and about people who govern nuclear weapons within the political order. But the basic claim of nuclear one worldism is that the viability of the state, even the largest territorial states, such as the United States and the Soviet Union, had been fundamentally compromised, if not essentially eliminated, by this enormous leap in violence capability. You have to remember that perhaps the most important fact about nuclear weapons is just how destructive they are. You know, we call them weapons, and they look like a bomb. You know, it's a small object, but you're basically looking at objects that are the size of a refrigerator, of a household appliance, that has the capability to completely obliterate a large metropolis. We are in a village-like situation with regard to proximity and with regard to our capacity to interact with each other. We have these nuclear weapons, and it's like we have an analogy here of our domiciles, of our houses. And, you know, we have how many tons of TNT equivalent per capita on the Earth? Imagine our house. Well, we're going to have, you know, crates and crates of dynamite. Where are we going to put it? And the triggering mechanism for this dynamite is in the hands of distant state leaders, many of whom, you know, have very dubious attributes.
Right.
And our backyard, you know, we've put powerful howitzers. so that if our neighbor down the block really becomes irritated, we can obliterate them. That's comic. It's preposterous, right? And the simple answer is we need to basically dismantle it all and establish systems of restraints. And we were significantly doing that. You know, one of the great experiments of the 20th century has been the nuclear arms control project. And it was making great progress. We reduced the number of deployed nuclear weapons dramatically, like by 80%. We abolished entire classes of nuclear weapons delivery systems. We had intrusive on-site inspection. And we had various cooperative monitoring activities. And we've let that fall apart.
So how would you say the kind of failure of the efforts towards nuclear non-proliferation have laid the groundwork for what we're seeing now in terms of the increasing privatization and militarization of space?
Nuclear proliferation is a specific case of a much more general phenomenon, a diffusion. You know, technology is invented one place and it's going to diffuse into the hands of people elsewhere. Now, in the case of nuclear weapons, the vast majority of states have said, we don't want it, and we don't want you to have it either. Remember this key fact about nuclear proliferation. The number of states that could have nuclear weapons, if they wanted them, would number into the many dozen. You have countries the size of North Korea, Israel, that have substantial nuclear arsenals. How many countries, you know, are the size of wealth, you know, technological maturity of those two countries? Virtually every country in Europe, right? So the point is that this is not a supply side problem. This is on the demand side.
So the problem of nuclear technology, the development of nuclear technology, gives us a sort of an interesting way into a sort of fundamental question animating a lot of technofuturism and specifically astrofuturism, as you put it, which is technology neutral, right? Is technology like a hammer, right? You can use it to build a house, you can use it to attack someone, you know, it just matters who's wielding it and for what purpose. So what would your view be on that?
Technology is neither good nor bad, but nor is it neutral. And what I mean by that is that every technology has the consequence of making some tasks easier, cheaper, quicker, while potentially making other tasks more difficult. So it's an empowerment in a very specific sort of vectored way. And the question of the consequence of that empowerment is very much dependent on what the agents do or don't do with these technologies. And so the larger planetary development since the middle years of the 20th century is that we now have a suite of what I call super technologies or superpowers that are, you know, multiple orders of magnitude faster, more destructive, you know, in terms of range than what had come before. That there's basically been this enormous leap in empowerment that humans have created for themselves. And of course, it's not every human on the average, it's states and, you know, the powerful groupings of humans have created. And the simple solution, the path to the solution, is to go back to our domicile, to our neighborhood, to our village, and basically say, we need to have arms control on a planetary scale that is analogous to what we have at that scale. There's this general notion that, oh, these problems are all so new, you know, these problems are so complex that we have to sort of reinvent. We're like starting from scratch. And I don't think that that's accurate. I think that we have been doing what we need to do now on smaller scales all along. And all we have to do now is do it at this one further scale up.
Tell me more about that. What does that look like for you when you're saying that we've been doing it all along? What are you pointing at?
I'm pointing out the fact that our houses, our vehicles have over time been developed, and they become much more powerful, and they produce, you know, much more output of the sorts that we want. And in the course of developing and deploying these our artifacts, we realize that, well, things can go wrong. You know, they can kill people, and that there are sort of, you know, default, you know, tendencies of these technologies. And so we've regulated them. We compensated, right? We have fire codes. We have fire standards with regard to the production of electrical items. We have fire insurance. We have fire departments. We make arson illegal, right? We have fire alarms, a whole panoply, you see, of things that we have done to prevent, you know, a catastrophic and existential outcome at that scale.
It's funny hearing you talk about this, because there's something almost heretical about those sentiments that we should do everything possible to avoid the temptations of, you know, Icarus, Prometheus, Dr. Frankenstein, all of these like literary figures who have meddled with technology in ways that they ultimately could not control. When you're talking to a techno-optimist, that circumspection or that suspicion is kind of completely alien. And your work seems to be a sort of an invitation to consider the kind of politics that can be signed off when we just sort of give ourselves over to complete techno-optimism.
More specifically, I believe that we have to be extremely clear-eyed about the full range of consequences from these very powerful technologies that we are introducing. And in some cases, we have to say no. I'm not in general opposed to technological or scientific development. My point is simply that we are producing capacities, empowerments, that agents within the human sphere are likely to use or trigger. And that given that, we have to have combinations of restraints that in some cases, you know, amount to prohibitions of certain artifacts and activities. In the same way that we do within a house or within a neighborhood, municipal planetary is a frame that I find useful.
Tell me more about those capacities and how they are linked up with what some people are calling a kind of new space age, where you're seeing, you know, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos sending all kinds of weapons. Excuse me, that's a Freudian slip. Sending all kinds of satellites, etc., into near Earth orbit.
Well, the first thing on this topic that we should always remember is that these activities of putting satellites up and using them for communications purposes and surveillance and navigation, observatories to look both at the cosmos and at the Earth, all of this is occurring in a part of the planet Earth. Right? We have this notion that when we leave the Earth's atmosphere, we've entered into a realm that extends to the, you know, observable edges of the observable universe, right? And that is true, but the part, the tiny minuscule part of space that is immediately around this planet is really part of the planet, because its distinctive features are defined by the rest of the planet, right? Gravity, magnetic field, radiation belts, right? All of that is the product of the other parts of the planet. And so we have, in terms of our basic geography for thinking about where we are, right, we all need to have the same mental map. We all need to have simple, accurate, consensus planetary geography. And space, the parts where we're doing things, is another layer of the planet that we should refer to as the astrosphere. Mm. So the planet is like an onion. You know, we have the lithosphere, and we have the hydrosphere, and we have the atmosphere, and then we have the astrosphere. Mm. And the astrosphere is obviously very unlike the other parts of the Earth, just as they are unlike each other, right? But we have this notion that it's very large and something that can be, you know, exploited, you know, without limit. And the reality is that it's relatively small and it's easily degraded. It's fragile, right? It's not an escape from the, you know, the vulnerabilities that we experience in the other spheres on the planet. It's just in a different form.
What kind of infrastructures have people, the private industry, governments, etc., set their sights on building? You hear a lot about construction in low gravity environments and asteroid mining and colonizing Mars and that kind of thing. It's hard to know sometimes how seriously to take these propositions, to tell whether they're theodicies to kind of just keep avoiding taxes on Earth, or whether they're sort of actually sort of seriously engaged with infrastructural projects for people looking to escape the resource limits of the planet.
Well, the amount of envisioning, imagining that has been done utterly dwarfs the amount that has actually been done, right? We've done virtually nothing compared to what the advocates claim is going to be feasible and would be desirable. So there's a long list, and of course it's constantly, you know, kind of in contestation, mutating, you know, in its various aspects. But it's a relatively simple vision, which is you start with, you're going to start building things, infrastructures, you know, like, you know, like dams or like railroads or, you know, urban complexes. You're going to build big artifacts, and you're going to be able to do all the things we do, you know, on Earth with such artificial habitations and infrastructures. And so how much can that go on? Well, you know, indefinitely, right? Because once we have learned how to build sort of a giant canister city, once we have learned how to build, you know, a giant canister city, we can just, you know, start producing more of them, and further out in space, right? Seeding the cosmos, trillions of people, right? Early stages will involve the colonization of Mars, and we'll come back to that in a minute. But the second feature of these visions is that we're going to use resources. We're going to be able to build these things with resources that are there, right? We're going to exploit resources for the construction of the essentially alt-Earths, micro-Earths. And yeah, we can bring some of those resources back to Earth, but the real agenda is to space resources for space development.
Tell me more about what role the idea of the colonization of Mars is playing in these sort of terrestrial political and economic dynamics.
Well, you know, back in the early part of the Copernican Revolution, going really up until well into the 20th century, the view was widely held that other planets in this solar system not only had life, but had intelligent life. multiple forms of intelligent life. So there was this assumption that if we see it on Earth, we're going to see it elsewhere. Right? And that was something that the major figures of European thought in the Enlightenment, not just thought, but wrote down and made claims about. Right? So it's very old. Right? Now, what has happened? We have better science. That is to say, we have explored. You know, we have actually learned the actual contours of these other bodies in the solar system. And it might be the case that there are, you know, microbial type organisms down in the crust of Mars and maybe someplace else. But all of these other planets are extraordinarily inhospitable. So the most important discovery in terms of, well, the space people have been doing all this astronomy, you know, give us a simple summary of what you found. And the simple summary is that there is an extraordinarily vast and inhospitable wilderness that is lifeless and hostile to life that spreads in all directions for at least trillions of miles.
I just got a shiver down my spine. Jesus, carry on.
And that within that space, and that's just what we have sort of, you know, more or less gotten a good sense of the mapping of, obviously less perfect as we go further out. But the most important finding that should be at the top of the list of what hath the space age wrought, it would be the fact of Oasis Earth. The fact that this planet is within this vast area, extraordinarily different. It is alive, and it contains, well, what the total number of species that have existed, you know, is estimated to be in the neighborhood of a billion, right? And it has existed and mutated in what we call evolution for now, what, 3.5 billion years? And our well-being in every respect depends upon the operation of this system, that the Earth is habitable for humanity. Mm. That's not cosmically inevitable. That's not cosmically permanent. And we may be doing things to significantly damage that capability. Oasis Earth is like a spaceship, and that the spaceship, like any spaceship, any ship, is subject to catastrophic outcomes.
I'd love to know more about what you frame as this kind of central paradox of contemporary astrofuturism, which is that it sometimes poses itself as an escape from terrestrial problems, both in terms of resource scarcity and political domination, but actually the solutions that it poses will sometimes or often maybe end up reinstating them, like re-embedding those dynamics.
Yes, well, the space advocates have a very developed and in many ways powerful set of arguments as to why we should, you know, pursue some version of their agenda towards a multi-planetary species. And the most important starting point for advocates of space is precisely the vulnerability of Earth. The fact that, you know, Planet A, you know, might fail. Planet A has all of these, you know, catastrophic scenarios, right? And so they advance space, most importantly, as buying a kind of species insurance, right? That we once we become multi-planetary, the prospect of our extinction would have to be said to go down. And then, of course, we have problems on Earth with regard to resources, so we'll bring resources from space. Asteroidal battles. We have energy problems. We'll collect solar energy in space and beam it down to Earth. Right? Also, the Earth is getting crowded, and we will be able to continue to have growth if we go into space, right? Continue to have innovation. Many of them then, of course, go a step further and say, this is beneficial to freedom, perhaps indispensable for freedom. The crowded, vulnerable character of the Earth, you know, is making freedom increasingly precarious, and solving the Earth's problems might require, you know, world government, which might actually be repressive in important ways. So we go into space for, you know, the project of liberation, of emancipation, for the maintenance of free government, for the maintenance of free individuality. This is the set of claims that they make, okay? Mm. So what you see is an enormously powerful rhetorical edifice. Everything that people want and all of the things that people are threatened by, to a first approximation, we can fundamentally alter by going into space.
So what do you think we should make of those kinds of propositions? Like, what are they doing politically when they're actually kind of operant on an economic and political level?
They're not doing much of anything yet. And that's, of course, the point, is that you go back to Mars, you raise the question, why is Mars so important? And the simple answer is that it's very inhospitable. It's vastly less hospitable than significant parts of the Earth. But compared to everywhere else in the solar system, it's relatively habitable. Right? It's the best of a really bad set.
So subtending these kinds of political offerings that you outline is a kind of strain of libertarianism, or like strains of libertarianism, which raises the question of, okay, what relationship between the state and private industry do these kinds of politics imply or even demand in order to sort of allow themselves to function, give themselves the economic and legal infrastructure on which they can actually function?
There is this very strong libertarian narrative. But there is also a very well-developed collectivist. And when I say collectivist, I mean deep collectivist, that within the tradition of Soviet and particularly Soviet, it really started in the Russian Empire, the Tsiolkovsky, continued in various forms of Soviet space futurism. Is that space will provide the locus for the achievement of true communism. That we can, and there's, you know, strong and stronger versions of that. And the strongest version is we can truly collectivize the human species. Right? And they point to the fact that ships, you know, are not democracies, and that the regulation of individual activities on a spaceship, you know, is considerably more necessary than it is, you know, on a farm, you know, in that an individual or small group of individuals could cause, you know, catastrophic failure of the life support system. And so from that fact, people deduce that there will be, you know, pretty hierarchical organizations. So there's a whole realm of people making claims of this sort on both sides. Right?
It's really interesting, that connection between the ship and the spaceship, because often you find space law kind of templated off maritime law. And also, long-time Navarro FM listeners may remember an interview that we did with scholar Marcus Redeker talking about historical and anthropological debates over the amount of democracy that are necessary within ships in the golden age, so-called, of sailing, in the golden age of piracy, even. This little derive, if you'll allow me, is all to say that, like, one's imagination of what space provides and what space sort of must look like in order to deliver on its utopian promises seems like a kind of reflection of one's ambitions for the planet as well.
Very much so, very much. Projections of debates about human nature, about human purpose, about human social and political organization that have been going on, you know, since the beginning, now will be operating, will be confronted with potentials for realization that are much greater than they have been in the past. You know, you got the libertarian, you got the communist, and you got, you know, transhumanism as a sort of a communist version, the Borg, right? But you also have colonization advocated for on the basis of pluralism, that one colony will be nudists, another colony will be Rothbardians, another colony will be, you know, golf enthusiasts, and so on and so on and so on, that we'll be able to have separate places for, you know, intentional communities. It's intentional communities.
The implication of, like, interstellar infrastructure for the nudist golfers among us, which I'm sure there are some. I would love to get your thoughts on that question of what the relationship is between state and private industry in this kind of new frontier of space technology, space exploration, and what might it be important for us to look at in those kind of new evolving formations?
Well, the role of private enterprise in the Western countries, of course, has been present since the beginning. Right? Private corporations had contracts with the government to build all this stuff, right? Some of it was built in, you know, government, you know, laboratories, and but most of it was built by private contractors. And then we had the development of the satellite communications industry, which was a breakthrough because it was the first time that a space activity didn't require the government to pay for it. It could be marketized. That started, you know, back in the 60s and has gotten successively, you know, dominant in that sector. But we also have, you know, the manned space program that requires government subsidy. We have space science that requires state subsidy, even if private corporations are contracted by the government to do things as part of that. And the military hiring companies to do things. SpaceX, their largest client is the U.S. government. And so the fundamental problem that hangs over space, the larger space project from the beginning and still now, is that in the absence of something that you can bring back and sell, there's no way any kind of private capital is going to invest in it.
So tell me more about how that has kind of evolved since the kind of the start of that mid-century period that we've been pointing out. And I'm particularly interested in how the end of the Cold War has impacted these dynamics.
As the price of telecommunication services has fallen and the demand, you know, has gone up, so there's been this, you know, mutation, evolution of the planetary communication and information system. And, you know, communication satellites are part of that. You know, fiber optics, you know, cell towers, you know, earlier telegraphs, so on. You know, that information and communication infrastructure has become big business, right? And so firms are doing it. You know, we don't have to have the government to do that. But these other areas are not going to happen unless the government or someone spends very large sums of money without anticipation of at least anywhere near term return. See, Elon Musk and developing these ships and so forth that he has and the satellite constellations, he is being paid to do that by somebody. And we would cross over a line, and this is kind of a challenge to him, really. He's worth how much money? Why doesn't he take 90, 95% of his wealth and give it to a Mars Colonization Foundation, which will basically spend it down, you know, until we're there or until they run out?
Elon Musk, if you're listening, the gauntlet has been laid down.
Well, you see, my point here is that these people say they're advocates of this, and they are also clearly making it, you know, more likely because of lowering costs. There's no doubt about that. But beyond that, you know, it's just another business.
So are we supposed to be taking these people seriously? By which I mean, are governments actually sort of setting their sights on these kinds of space-going technologies as a solution to the kinds of problems that you point out, like are radically shaping or radically need to shape the kinds of questions that are being asked through and with these technologies, most acutely that of climate change, right? I have heard the sort of, you know, don't worry about mitigating emissions now, we'll just put a big space mirror up there in like 20 years' time and everything will be fine.
The climate change issue has got a lot of fascinating overlaps with space. For one thing, we have important parts of our data, scientific understanding of this comes from satellites. There's been a tremendous set of advances in understanding the natural Earth that has occurred over the space age. You know, there's been, it's almost like a rediscovery of the Earth. You know, it's a paradigm shift in how we can think about the Earth that has occurred during this period, and space has been part of that. So what about high-tech, space-based solutions to the climate crisis? The short answer is the costs and lead times, let alone assurance of feasibility, are on decades scales, while we need to be doing things at scale now. We have technological advances in photovoltaics, in batteries, in wind, in insulation and efficiency, that in terms of their cost for reducing carbon are just much less. Right? We have a cheap solution now, and they're proposing an expensive solution that will kick in later. That seems like an easy choice.
And you come back to this question of the link between technology and politics, right?
Yeah.
Whereby the kinds of techno-optimism that you sometimes see within this field tend to lead themselves, or lead us rather, maybe to forms of technocracy or maybe autocracy. Can you talk to us about that?
Technological futurism and the core of scientific technological modernity is, from its beginnings, had a powerfully autocratic strain to it. The person that we think more than anyone else as the founder of modern science methodologically and technological transformationalism as a path for revolutionizing the human estate, it's Francis Bacon. And in The New Atlantis, which is, despite all that's been written about it, a fairly inscrutable work, it's clear that there's no democracy anywhere in sight. Right? And there was very much a kind of Machiavellian you know, autocratic order in which everything was kept in its appropriate realm. And, you know, in the Enlightenment, despotism, enlightened despotism, not democracy. And you come into our period and you have this, it's a type of libertarianism, but it's an elitist libertarianism. Ayn Rand, the Fountainhead, a lot of these people that are in the vanguard with regard to space expansion activities and the sort of public face of the space, the pro-space narrative, they are firm Randians. And they have the notion, you know, it's basically upside down Marxism. It's that the elite, the very few, are the sources of human progress, right? That they are the real, you know, engines of advance and the creation of wealth. And basically everyone else is a parasite. And so the agenda is, you know, to liberate them.
Liberate them from the world rather than the world from whatever it's got going on, kind of thing.
Taxes, regulation, let them do their thing.
So what's the connections there between that strain of thinking and what you identify as a colonial imaginary of space? That it's kind of leaning on very, very old tropes of conquest, frontiersmanship, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, the space expansionist narrative emphasizes that the larger trajectory of the human species has been one of expansion across frontiers on the Earth, out of Africa, out of the old world, out of the Earth. That frontiers have been an omnipresent, you know, feature of human polities, and that the advocates basically say, we don't have any more on Earth. We gotta, you know, follow them to where they are, and that's in space. And so this ultimate frontier, final frontier, science, the limitless frontier, all of these types of characterizations are very foundational to how these people view this.
So instead of that neocolonial imaginary, you talk about planetary security. Now, that might differ a little bit from what we conventionally understand security to look like. Can you tell us what you mean by this and what it might entail?
An important point often overlooked by critics, which is that the colonization that we have seen on the Earth all presupposed, depended upon, imperialism, the invasion of the living space of one group by another to either displace them or dominate them in some fashion. Mm-hmm. Right, that's imperialism. Colonization is when the population from one area goes into these adjacent larger areas. One of the important, for the advocates, benefits of space is that we can have colonization without imperialism. There's no natives, right? There's no one to turn into slaves. There's no one to steal their precious metals. And that actually means that it's less feasible, because imperialism and colonization on the Earth did depend upon going to places and being able to extract from them.
Right, it was a feature, not a bug.
That's right.
So tell me more about why you are an advocate of retiring that imaginary, retiring those efforts altogether. Why are you against those kinds of Mars colonization ideas?
Well, I think that the colonization project is one which we have not been looking at in a clear-eyed manner. And I think that when you begin to think about what would be entailed in humanity becoming a multi-planetary species, I want to argue that it's a mixed basket of positive and negative outcomes. And one of them certainly is that we would have a certain type of existential risk insurance, right? That we would, our eggs would no longer be just in one basket, see, and thus less subject to, you know, catastrophic egg breaking. So let's think about what a colonization would entail politically. What would the world order, the human world order, look like? And first of all, it would be enormously dispersed. Okay, it would be within what I call a solar archipelago. Think of Pacific islands, and then imagine them at distances that are 40 or 50 times the circumference of the Earth. So it's going to be a very, very large space within which the colonies will be tiny for a very long time, right? Second, we have to expect, and the advocates all advocate and predict, that these other world populations of humans will become politically independent of the Earth. We'll have a multi-state system. And the main thrust of my argument is to say, well, if we have in that state system the types of interactions that we have within terrestrial state systems, then this would be a very undesirable thing to do. Why do we have wars? And political science has a lot of different explanations, but certainly one set of them have to do with the character of the units, with the character of the polities, with the character of the states. And the advocates all say, and it seems logical, that these colonies will develop very different identities politically.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So they're going to be very far away. They're going to develop very different identities. Also, the relative power between them and us is inevitably going to shift over time from overwhelmingly dominated by us to a situation of greater equality, to a situation of wherein outworld humans and their polities will vastly dwarf the capabilities of terrestrial humans.
Mm.
The balance between them is going to be shifting. Shifts of relative power are widely seen as a significant source of violent conflict. Another feature that directly relates to the security problem, the violence problem, is the violence potential of space. We saw earlier the idea, the practice of ballistic missiles using orbital space, you know, as an avenue, as a bridge to other places on the Earth. But we need to recognize that the space environment itself is intrinsically violent in ways that are simply not experienced in the terrestrial Earth. And this is because everything that is in space is traveling at extraordinarily high velocities. Simply to be in orbit, they're going to be going like 17,000 miles an hour. To leave the Earth's gravity and go into the inner solar system, you've got to be going at least 25,000 miles an hour. And we routinely see objects, you know, that are moving at 40,000 miles an hour. Now, the fundamental fact is that inherent in a realm with that level of velocity is a prodigious and ever-at-hand volume of violence.
Mm-hmm.
An object the size of a pea at orbital velocity will cause a significant, you know, explosion, will punch through thick metal.
Mm.
And so you have objects that are the size of buildings, objects that are the size of automobiles, you know, a whole spectrum, right? All the way up and down. Also, the space environment has violence potential because of the large number of objects that are present. The near-Earth objects, the asteroids, there are tens of thousands of smaller bodies. And of course, those bodies strike the Earth naturally. And part of the reason for going into space is to develop the capability to deflect them. But there's vast numbers of them, and they're going on their own paths, right? And the advocates all point to the asteroids as the resource base, right? That's where they're going to get the resources to build all these things. They're going to develop the ability to go to an asteroid, to process it in various ways, and then to move it, to alter its orbit in very precise ways so that it can go exactly where they want it. If we do mine the asteroids and bring metal back to the Earth, there will have to be frequent orbital insertions of, you know, building-size objects in Earth's orbit. And, you know, what could go wrong? If there's 1% of them, you know, orbit, deorbit, you know, you'll get a giant explosion. The point being is that the environment is overwhelmingly violent. And another indicator of that, to sort of register this, a rough back-of-the-envelope calculation is that the asteroids in the inner solar system have seven orders of magnitude more destructive power than all nuclear weapons.
Wow.
So we got interstate anarchy, in which the units are very different. We have shifting balances of power, frontier potential for conflicts. And we have all of this going on in an environment where violence capacity is super abundant. Right? It's a natural feature of these places. Right? Always a step or two from being employed. So we're going to have a tendency for war. We're going to have this enormous violence potential. And we can expect there to be total wars. Another point against the colonization agenda has to do with technologies of biological engineering and of artificial intelligence. The advocates and the scientific visionaries have always had space transhumanism and cyborgization, artificial intelligence, all interwoven. Humans are not well suited to the space environment. So there's the assumption that they're going to evolve naturally, but hey, we have the technology, or we will have the technology to direct it, to refashion the fabric of human being, to make it them suitable to these environments. So we're going to have, you know, what biologists would refer to as a species radiation here. We'll have a situation in which there will be at least two, maybe multiple, intelligent species with advanced technology in this solar system, one of which will be us. What could go wrong? Why would we create a situation in which we would be surpassed and potentially annihilated by some form of successor species?
I'd love to direct us back, if I may, to the question that you propose as a kind of alternative to these sorts of misguided forms of utopianism, if indeed we are crediting with them with a form of utopianism, which is what you call an Earth-orientated space program. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes. I think we should, for the foreseeable future, agree that we do not want to do Mars, that we do not want to do colonization. And we need to focus on the Earth. The Earth is this special place. It's got all these vulnerabilities. Many of these vulnerabilities are anthropogenic in character. Some of them are acute. We need to focus on addressing the threats to Spaceship Oasis Earth. Dismantle the nuclear Armageddon gadget. Dismantle the species suicide apparatus that we've spent so much money, you know, building. This marvel of science and technological innovation now stands ready at a moment's notice to obliterate civilization and maybe destroy the species. Let's dismantle that. A more general point that I would leave with, or in some ways begin with, is that a most basic point that I would both begin and end with is that we live in the most consequential and interesting era of human history. Over the course of the decades of this century, humanity is going to make, by commission or omission, decisions whose consequences will determine the survival of our civilization, perhaps the survival of our species, and the longer-term habitability of the Earth. And this is the most interesting era because the task of making those choices right is a governance question that is about the most fundamental features of human association and about our capacity to do what we need to do to survive.
And on that rallying cry to focus our space energies elsewhere, that's probably, sadly, all we've got time for. That's why I could talk to you about this for hours. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for this opportunity to talk about these questions.
Support independent journalism and set up a regular donation to Novara Media from just £1 a month. Head to novara.media/support.